The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. I am absolutely delighted to be joined today by Dr. Curtis White, who is a PhD candidate in English Literature at Ulster University. And he has very excitingly recently completed and defended his PhD thesis, which is comparing T.S. Eliot and C.S. Lewis along theological lines. Curtis is also one of the organisers of the C.S. Lewis Symposium in Northern Ireland. Curtis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's wonderful to be with you. I've enjoyed the show for a long time, so thank you very much.
Oh, well, it's nice to hear that. There's so much I want to unpack with you today. What an amazing, interesting PhD thesis and everything that's going on with the C.S. Lewis Symposium. But I guess before we delve into all of that, would you just say a little bit about how your own journey began with C.S. Lewis? What was your first encounter with C.S. Lewis?
Well, I suppose my first encounter was in childhood with the Narnia Chronicles. As a little kid, just kind of getting lost in the ordinary way and the imagination of Lewis and those striking images that he has for kids of Narnia and of Aslan and the depictions of ultimate goodness that you sort of are immediately struck by when you enter into Narnia and Lewis's writings. And then for years and years, I suppose I set aside Lewis and didn't kind of consistently stick with him, which is a bit unusual. A lot of people will tend to, once they get bitten by Lewis, stay with him, right, for the duration. But I kind of wandered away, and only in my sort of later life, and I had sort of wandered away from my Christian faith as well. And so only much, much later in life, when I picked up Mere Christianity, did I sort of get reintroduced to Lewis the Apologist. Lewis, the equally compelling creator of images, striking images of goodness that persuade you by their beauty as to the truth of what he's saying. Those memorable lines. I think you had a guest recently who was describing the way in which the one thing that Christianity cannot be is unimportant. Either it's a thing of absolute and vital importance, and that it influences everything we do, or it's of no importance at all. And Lewis manages to capture that in that same lovely way that he manages to create fictional characters. And so I kind of came back to Lewis much later in life and then re-explored all of the Narnia stuff. Began reading the science fiction work, the Cosmic Trilogy, and obviously his essays, have been devouring his essays, and have found that same sort of skill in terms of his language, the ability to put things concretely and just so sweetly without, as it were, losing anything in translation. It's simple, precise language that loses nothing. It doesn't dumb anything down. He respects his reader. Anyway, that was a long-winded answer.
That was a great one. Do you feel like Lewis has helped you at all on your faith journey?
Yes. I mean, without C.S. Lewis, I don't know that I would be a practicing Christian again. I mean, he's been absolutely integral. He's been absolutely integral to that. Again, just picking up Mere Christianity, I can still remember the day, I just got out of the bookshop and had just picked it up, and I couldn't even wait to get home to crack it open. I was sitting in the car park, just devouring the thing. And it was just, you know, the light and the insights that came off, and also the warmth that comes off of his insights. It's not just a matter of the head for him, but a matter of the heart. And it's that same thing you get from the Chronicles of Narnia, you know, that you can feel the warm breath and the fur and the kind of the loving nature of Aslan. There's a kind of generosity of spirit that he brings to everything. And to me, that's bound up with how much he wants to be clear with people. And he wants to put across his own faith in a way that people can really grasp it and understand it. So Lewis the Apologist was really the hook for me again, much more recently in my life, that then brought me back to re-explore all that wonderful stuff that I enjoyed in him as a child.
This might be a really, well, I suppose it's a massive question, isn't it? But why do you think Lewis resonates with you personally?
I think it's that he, and this might sound strange at first, but I think it's that he's a very daring writer. He risks being dangerous at times, actually. He says things in a kind of direct way. He doesn't fear what the response is going to be. He just speaks the truth as he sees it, and he lets it lie. I suppose he'll say things like, in Mere Christianity, you know, there's no use being more spiritual than God. God created matter. He likes it. He says things like that, and you're kind of taken aback in the same way that you would be taken aback by somebody at a party who is just incredibly direct, is saying very interesting and compelling things in a way that's just very direct and not gussied up, and he's not pandering to an audience. He's just saying things as they are. And I find that very, it's like an antidote to much of the stuff that we see around us in the world today. It's this clarity that we wish that all, in this honesty, frankly, that he brings to things. And that quality of danger, too, that I mentioned. There's a scene in Is It the Silver Chair where Pole is coming up and she's by the river and Aslan's there by the river. And she's concerned she needs a drink. And of course, she's incredibly thirsty. And she sees this wild animal and she says, you know, are you tame? Are you safe? And he responds in the most counterintuitive way possible. No, I am not safe. I've devoured little girls before. And you're thinking, wow, that's not how I expected that to go. And yet, again, the bravery, the courage with which he expresses a fundamental truth of our faith, which is that, yeah, I mean, that encounter is an encounter which demands everything from you. You will not come out of it unchanged. It may require a great sacrifice, but it will be worth it. And he doesn't flinch when it comes to the point of telling the full truth. And I suppose that's the thing that really, really makes him resonate with me.
Curtis, tell us about the C.S. Lewis Symposium. Where did the idea for the conference come from? How did it start? Share a little bit about what your thoughts were and hopes were for it.
Yeah, well, of course, the conference begun a couple of years back when I was doing the PhD. My cohort and I were doing the PhD at Ulster University. So that was sort of where the initial ideas for this crazy thing of ours sort of got off the runway, you know, in highly caffeinated conversations, you know, late in the evening with my fellow PhD researchers, who were all wonderful and lovely and really helped to kind of incubate this event. And Ulster University were wonderful in providing the funding and a location to kind of host us, and just really did something really special and kind of supporting us. And But at any rate, so it began a couple of years back. And the idea was that we were just coming out of lockdown. Remember that strange sort of time when the world was not yet real again to us. We had been sort of interacting digitally almost exclusively. There was all the, I remember teaching a course or a seminar, and it was like I was interacting with students who were all just sort of black boxes on a screen. And there was this real disembodied sort of feeling. And so we came upon the idea in conversations of calling it Now We Have Faces. It was a kind of return to, you know, being together in flesh and blood, incarnate, so to speak, in the same physical space, gathering together to talk about C.S. Lewis. And so that was the first event and how the whole thing started. And then we did another event about Lewis and his relationship to Ireland, and had the wonderful David Clare, who I know you've recently had his talk on your show. He was kind enough to join us there and to speak about that. And then last year we had a sort of truncated event with a new sponsorship, the C.S. Lewis Institute Belfast, who are now sponsoring and primarily organizing the symposium this year. I'm just sort of assisting them and helping them behind the scenes. And this year the idea was, how does Lewis talk about challenging and difficult things? How does he, in a way that he never seems to flinch, how does he deal with tough subjects? Well, there's no tougher subject, certainly, than last things, than eschatology. And so we wanted to go to the great man again on this one and to see if we could get a group of scholars together from around the world to talk about different aspects of Lewis and Last Things. And the sort of the papers that we've attracted are really quite diverse and quite interesting. There'll be people talking about the last battle and people talking about the world's last night, Lewis and music and Last Things. We'll have some folks like Malcolm Guyton and Jerry Root who are going to be dipping into a little bit of T.S. Eliot, I think, as well, to talk about how the end is the beginning and things like that. So really, it was just that same impulse about exploring with Lewis difficult topics, because he's just so clear on these things. And we're just really amazed by the response that we got from people from all over the world. We can't wait to host everybody on the 4th of November at Union Theological. We just think it's going to be pretty dynamite. We're really, really pleased with the result. God willing, it'll be a great event.
So how do people find out more about the event and get tickets if they're available on the 4th of November?
Yes. Unfortunately, we have a very clunky sort of Eventbrite. It's a very long kind of thing. But if you just Google C.S. Lewis and Last Things Belfast, you'll find as one of the first sort of items in Google, the Eventbrite listing where you can go and you can purchase tickets for it. You'll see the little C.S. Lewis Institute Belfast little red square logo there, and you'll know you're in the right place. So just Google that, the C.S. Lewis and Last Things Belfast, and you'll find us.
Great. I'll make sure there's a link in our notes as well. I've got a link from the last two shows that David Clare has done as well. Just before we move on to your PhD, so I'm desperate to dive into some of that. Yeah. The conference that David Clare was speaking at that we've been transmitting most recently was on Lewis's Irishness, which is not often covered. I mean, why does his Irishness matter, and how significant was it that you were holding this in Northern Ireland where he was from?
Yeah, well, we think it's very significant, and we think that in many ways we've only just begun to kind of scratch the surface of the ways in which his Irish and particularly his Northern Irish background informs the kind of thinker and the kind of writer that he is. As a kind of aside, but it's related, for example, his childhood home, Little Lee, is a place that was really central to kind of his imagination. I mean, he describes the way in which this is a home that has all sorts of drafty corridors and the very method of its construction. He says kind of in a humorous vein that his father was always getting taken advantage of by workmen and things, builders and things like that. And so there'd be lots of dead space in the building. Well, it turns out those dead spaces end up firing his imagination. Mm-hmm. This home is so central to Narnia. So anyway, the physical home, the homestead, of course, is a massive aspect of it. The kind of rich cultural environment that he comes out of is obviously another big aspect of who he is as a person that's very under-evaluated. I think David Clare did a great job kind of beginning that conversation. And it's certainly a conversation which, you know, watch this space, we'd like to continue, you know, to kind of develop here and to develop some sort of research center, hopefully here in Northern Ireland, that can be a big part of that discussion.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Let's have a look at your PhD. I mean, it's quite a large work. I did actually read it this morning. It was very interesting. But your PhD focuses on C.S. Lewis and T.S. Eliot, and you gave it the title Two Writers Divided by a Common Faith. Why Yes. did you decide to research this particular area?
There was just something. I wish I could pinpoint the precise moment, but I suppose it just begun in because I just recently, before starting the PhD, written a master's dissertation on T.S. Eliot, It's called From Dust to Dirt Toward the Life of Significant Soil. It was all about the kind of irrigation of the wasteland that occurs for Eliot after his conversion to Christianity, after his, or his reconversion, his reversion to kind of to Christianity. And so I had just begun, I just was fresh off thinking about Eliot. And then I just sort of, my mind naturally gravitates back to Lewis wherever I go and whatever I do. And so I just begun sort of automatically almost comparing the two and noticed some very sort of serious kind of differences in the way that they use language and the kind of, I guess you call it a difference in the genius that each has. It's a very different kind of impulse, I think. I think the, I mean, I'm certainly taking a bit of poetic license with the idea that they're divided by a common faith. That's very poetic, of course, because of course they are ultimately on the same team and they do reconcile, I believe, in friendship later on, even though, as I say, you know, I don't think Lewis was ever exactly on board with some of Eliot's poetry and some of his aesthetic philosophy, and maybe even some of his theology, perhaps. But anyway, they were brothers in arms. And I think at the end of the day, you know, it's a testament ultimately to the kind of charity that Lewis had, that he set aside his arms and just said, I love the man at the end of the day. So long way of saying, I had just sort of been looking at Eliot, and then I just begun to kind of, you know, these ideas about the differences in the quality of the way they use language just began to line up in my mind. And then they kept lining up in a way that it sort of insisted upon itself as something that I should look at. And so that was where the idea was born.
So what are some of those key differences between Lewis and Eliot, and why are they significant, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think there's a kind of aesthetic philosophy, I think, that and some will disagree with this, I'm sure, but that is at variance or at odds. I think whereas Lewis aims for clarity and concreteness, for a kind of lucidity, where this is interesting. If you take Aslan as an example, I mean, can you think of any author who has translated, as it were, logos, word made flesh, in a way that can be represented in a figure and lose nothing in translation? That's a marvelous feat. So he's rendered clear something that should be utterly mystical and impossible for us to understand. So that's his approach. I think if you look at Aslan, you can see it. It's concrete, it's lucid. A thing for Lewis doesn't lose its mystery or its importance or its power in being clearly expressed. I think that's how I would say it. Whereas I think for Eliot, it's very different. For Eliot, there's a sense that the thing, that the divine is always at a degree separate from us. And he's, of course, correct. I mean, we exist in a tradition where we acknowledge that God is, in a certain sense, utterly, you know, other than us. And yet he is present to us always, always with us, always animating us. He's the ground of our being. But I think the difference is that for Eliot, he's emphasizing always the otherness, the separateness, the mystery, the gap, so to speak, between us and the divine. And I think that romantic Lewis is always kind of drawing upon the analogy between heaven and earth, always showing the good there in the light of the good here, and helping us to understand that though they are not equivalent domains, there is an analogical relationship. There is a connection that we can, so to speak, get there from here. And I find that sort of comparison fascinating. So if you have a look at the end of Little Gidding, if you have a look at this image of the fire and the rose becoming one, it's very abstract. It's very mystical. It's beautiful. It's lovely. It's compelling. It's powerful. It's some of the best that Eliot ever wrote. It's some of the best maybe that any modern poet ever wrote. But it has a very different quality and character to the way that Lewis approaches language. And so I just became fascinated by that comparison. And I began to see them more and more in terms of different approaches to the divine. The via negativa, or the kind of apophatic, the renunciatory kind of way, the way of wanting a kind of direct contact with the divine unmediated by material creation, by physical things, which is, of course, a rich tradition within Christianity and a perfectly viable and valid one, you know. But then the Lewis side, the idea that you could make valid comparisons between ordinary human love and the love between that the Father has for all of us. These are very different approaches, and yet they both exist within our rich Christian tradition. And so that's why I took the poetic license of saying that they were two writers divided in some sense by a common language, a common faith, pardon me, Freudian slip. The apocryphal quotation that I'm kind of drawing from is the Shaw quotation about America and Britain being two countries divided by the same language. Mm. And so I saw this as a linguistic issue, essentially, as a way, a difference in the way that these two writers used language.
So do we know much about what their relationship was like and whether they influenced each other's literary careers at all, what they thought of each other's writings as much as what they thought of each other as people?
Yes. Well, we know much more about what Lewis thought about Eliot. So appropriately, he's vocal and he's putting a concrete, you know, he's putting it in tangible terms we can all kind of talk about. I think Eliot says a lot with silence, you know, which is maybe appropriate. But we do know that, you know, certainly Lewis was very critical, not just of Eliot the man, but of Eliot the poet and Eliot the literary critic. He's very critical of the idea that Eliot expresses about the fact that where Eliot says that that great poets ought to be the ones who have the conversations about poetry and determine what poetry is and what it means. I think Lewis rightly points out, and I'm on Lewis's side very much on this aspect of it, that would be a little bit absurd. That would mean that nobody could discuss it except for the great poets. And who's the great poets? Who's to say? The logic implodes there at a certain point. And he had all sorts of sort of schemes to catch Eliot out and to publish things in the Criterion that would embarrass him and things like that. So it was kind of a schoolyard kind of a dynamic, you know, there. But he is very critical of him. He does say some very unflattering things about him. He does actually use the word dangerous when he's describing Eliot's aesthetic philosophy and some of his work. And he does say, according to Walter Hooper, at the end of his life, that though he never actually did come to like or love Eliot's poetry, that he did come to love the man himself. So there's a record of consistent criticism, of consistent critiques, not just of the man, but of his work, from more or less start to finish. They did work together appropriately enough on the Psalms, on the Psalter, to come as literary, they were literary advisors. So they were there to make sure that the updating of the Psalter, that it retained its kind of, its beauty. And there's something very interesting to me in the fact that in terms of my own way of looking at it, these two different linguistic impulses in these two men come together to kind of unite to tackle this one task. So they do relate. They do end up in a place of friendship. Their wives meet. They have dinner. And it's ultimately, I think, a eucatastrophe rather than a catastrophe. It is a kind of happy ending.
And many people draw on Charles Williams's death as a significant moment where they reunited. Why was that?
Yes, well, it certainly was. I mean, Williams, you know, had an interest, obviously, in bringing these two men back together. He was a mutual friend of theirs. And he was the one who orchestrated their meeting. And it just, it kind of didn't go particularly well initially. But then after Williams dies, I think that there is a kind of detente there. And certainly, I think you have maybe the beginnings, at least, of Lewis deciding to lay down the spear and to no longer regard Eliot as his white whale who needs slaying, but as a kind of brother in arms. And so, yeah, I would say the Williams death appropriately does sort of, in a certain sense, mend things to a certain extent, at least, although there is disagreement on that.
And you mentioned, obviously, and a lot of your PhD revolves around the fact that they have got these different theological approaches, directions, dispositions, positions, whatever you want to call it. But how did each of them weave their Christian faith into their work? Was the way they did that really different as well as their approach?
Well, I think it was a part. It was a part of everything that Lewis wrote. Christianity was, I mean, again, the one thing it cannot be is unimportant. The one thing it cannot be is relevant to everything. So it shows up in everything that Lewis writes, and I think that the same is true for Eliot in ways that are maybe harder to detect, at least initially. But certainly he's writing essays on the importance of Christian culture, the importance of Christianity in culture. He's very much involved and invested in the question of how, you know, kind of the Christian patrimony should continue to shape the culture moving forward. This is something that he's actively very much involved in. And so I would say it's at the heart of everything that he's doing too. And of course, the Four Quartets, a profoundly kind of Christian work. It's incredibly powerful stuff. So I would say that Christianity is obviously central to the creative work and certainly the essays and things in the case of Eliot and Lewis for both of them.
And obviously we've mentioned Mere Christianity, and Lewis is renowned for a lot of his Christian apologetic writings, including Mere Christianity. Yeah. Do we know if T.S. Eliot engaged in religious apologetics at all through his poetry or through his essays? And if so, was his approach different to Lewis in that respect?
Yes, it would have been very different. So he wouldn't have been sort of aimed at a popular audience, I don't think as much, which is a major difference, I think, in the way that they use language. I think it comes down to that again. So, you know, you didn't have him sort of doing popular apologetics in the same way that Lewis would have. He wasn't sort of speaking to ordinary people, if you will, really. I don't think to the same extent that Lewis did. He didn't, I don't know that was his audience necessarily. So there would have been a very profound difference there in who their audiences were, I would say. Yeah.
And do you think there are any lessons that we, in a 21st century context, that in many ways is actually quite different from when Lewis and Eliot were writing, are there lessons that we can learn from these men?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, as I've said, you know, particularly Lewis, you know, has so many relevant things to say, not just about the faith, but about the world. I mean, it's sort of his prescience as a kind of science fiction writer is pretty incredible. When you look at an essay like, you know, Men Without Chests, or The Abolition of Man, Men Without Chests is part of that. You can see that this is a person who is diagnosing to a great degree a lot of things that are going wrong with the culture. And they were going wrong at that point in a kind of a very, very initial way. The germinal, the kind of seeds of that stuff was already beginning in his own day. So he has a tremendous amount in particular, I would say, to teach us. I mean, I'll be reading and rereading Abolition of Man and his essays for the rest of my life in a way that, I mean, I think it rises to the level of philosophy. I don't know if it's Peter Kraft who talks about the fact that Lewis is one of the most significant public philosophers of the 20th century. And I think that that's proven truer every day, particularly as a work like that matures and shows itself to be more relevant over time.
Well, as you say, Lewis tends to sort of give credence to the layman, the ordinary writer, as opposed to the poet and the people who are slightly on a sort of higher realm, whatever that means.
Yes.
So in that case, I know there are some people who would be desperate to get into C.S. Lewis, but struggle perhaps with the language, the slightly archaic language or the anachronistic metaphors or whatever it is. Is there any advice that you would give to someone in that situation? Is there a particular work that you would recommend reading first? Is there a way that you would recommend approaching some of this work just in order to make it slightly easier for the average person on the street to understand?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things I would actually recommend. Number one, I would recommend availing yourself of YouTube, right? There's wonderful talks. I mean, Malcolm Guite, Jerry Root. I mean, there's a universe, just if you stuck with those two guys alone, never mind your podcast. I mean, there's tons of stuff, right? Mm. That if you want to get a kind of primer on Lewis and you want to get into that conversation about Lewis, there's lots of people who have done that work for you. So avail of that. I would also say don't be it is a bit archaic sometimes, funny enough. I mean, here I am talking about how clear he is, but in a certain sense, he is a writer from a different period, right? So there are kind of barriers. But I would say, yeah, where it's archaic and where it's difficult, just don't give up on it, right? Mm. Just don't worry about the bits that you don't quite understand right now. Power through them. Ignore it. Just go on to the bits until you find something that catches your eye, and then meditate on it. Think about it. And let it work on you over time. Don't worry about getting it all at once. And I would say, if you want to start with something that's very readable, and if you're interested particularly in exploring the Christian faith, obviously pick up Mere Christianity. Just pick it up. Just read bits and pieces of it. Read chunks of it. You don't have to read all of it if you don't have the time. Just read in the direction of your interest. Always read in the direction of your interests. And I would say, if you're looking for a bit of his fiction, I would say you pick up The Great Divorce. I would recommend The Great Divorce. I think it's absolutely fantastic. The way his depiction of the afterlife and of eternity is like immediately compelling. And it's just a fascinating, fascinating read. And I think it's a pretty friendly read as well for everybody.
Curtis, thank you so much. And don't forget to check out the C.S. Lewis Symposium if you are free and available on the 4th of November. I will stick the details of how you can get involved in that in the show notes. But Curtis, thank you so much for joining us today.
That's great. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you. It was good meeting you.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.